Welcome to Resistance Radio. I'm John Cain, and I'm happy to be here and happy to have you listening in on us. We are streaming live on Facebook, and we are airing in Washington, D.C. this week, not in New York City. So let me take care of a few things right off the bat, as I always do. We aren't in New York City today because, frankly, they're in a mad dash on a fun drive, and basically most of our stations, Pacifica stations, are usually somewhat underfunded and are always, you know, struggling to keep the lights on, keep us on air. So for those of you who are listening online, listening on Facebook, watching on Facebook, or listening in Washington, D.C., I do ask that you go to the WPFW pledge line, and that number is 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Or go online to WPFWFM.org and follow the prompts and make a donation. You can do a one-time donation. You can do a timed donation. You can sign up so monthly contributions come out through your checking account or off a credit card. And those are called sustaining members. And we greatly appreciate those because even though it's a smaller amount, it's monthly and it becomes something that we can count on, we can budget on. So we really do appreciate the sustaining members of these stations and of WPFW in particular. Look, I'm grateful to be on the air in New York City and Washington, D.C. And of course, you know, any one of us can step on and do a podcast, and the show goes up as a podcast. We can do that without a radio station. We can stream live on Facebook or any other part of social media. But to be on the radio is kind of a whole nother level. As my good friend Michael G. Haskins back at WBAI used to say, there's a difference between narrowcasting and broadcasting. And broadcasting is when you can put our voices, our shows out there. And sometimes people catch it by happenstance. They just happen to turn on the radio, or perhaps they listen to a station at another time and they click it on and all of a sudden they hear something they've never heard before. I know a lot of the people who listen to the show have stumbled upon it accidentally. Now, for streaming online, however you do it, whether it's, you know, Facebook live stream or a podcast, somebody's got to look for you. They've got to have every intent to find you and check out your content. And that's the difference between narrowcasting and broadcasting. I love the idea of broadcasting. I certainly like doing the narrowcasting as well, but in order for us to do this, we need your support. And look, I've talked about Land Back on this program before and our efforts to deal with everything from land claims to reacquisition of lands to figuring out ways of reacquiring lost lands. But when we talk about Land Back, and sometimes it's physically taking land. I don't want to leave that off the docket. There are examples throughout history where we have taken a stand and we physically have reacquired lost land. But Land Back isn't just about land. It's about space. It's about being able to take a space or occupy a space. So it may be real estate, it may be property as some people know it, but it's column inches in print. It's airtime on the radio or on television. And so if you believe that Native people deserve to have land return, if you think Land Back is something that we deserve, then I have to assume that you believe we deserve airtime as well. So if you do, if you believe we deserve airtime, you have control over that. You can make a contribution to this station in the name of Resistance Radio to ensure that I'm on the air. Look, in a perfect world, there would be, you know, broadcasters in general. There would be these media outlets that would just give us free airtime. And this is essentially like that, but nothing is free. It's got to be paid for at some point. So because these stations don't have the resources to just put people on the air without any ability to raise funds, we ask you. We ask you, the consumer. We ask you, the listener. And look, and I hope that when you listen to the show, you hear something you've heard before. I assume when you listen to the show, you're going to hear something you've never heard before. And some of it may be troubling. Some of it may be distressing. But even if it's uncomfortable, I would like to think that once you've heard it, you become a little bit of a better person for having to digest it. And I know it's difficult. I know it's difficult to understand the whole notion that there are people that are not necessarily a part of the United States, are not necessarily embracing of the so-called American dream, when that's what's spoon-fed to you everywhere. You know, and it's a part of the immigration dialogue. It's a part of every anthem, every song, every pledge is about how great America is. So when you hear somebody speak from a people who are older than America, and it doesn't jive with what you have been led to believe, I know sometimes it's difficult. So that's kind of our task here. That is kind of our task here. You know, I've talked about the fact that next month is essentially the 100th anniversary of the Indian Citizenship Act, where they declared that we were U.S. citizens. They didn't ask. I mean, look, there were some Native people who were striving to be American citizens, but not all of us were. Some of us were still stinging from, you know, some of the brutality that our people experienced at the hands of the U.S. military and the politics and the corporations and everybody else who's put us in their crosshairs. And some of us are still stinging from that. So when we enter this time of year and in this election cycle, invariably Native people get confronted with, would you like to register as a Democrat? Would you like to register as a Republican? And so we oftentimes have to have that conversation with somebody who doesn't even understand that perhaps we don't fully embrace this notion of being an American citizen or voting in those elections. And, you know, a friend of mine who's been on the show many times, we were just speaking about this last week. And he's at a place, he was at an auction, and he run, and they're set up at this public auction place, some voter registration. And when he confronted them with this, no, I'm not an American, it just totally blew the guy's mind. He couldn't understand. He goes, well, you mean it's like this? And he goes, no, in his case, he's Seneca. I'm Mohawk. No, we're not Americans. Yeah, but you guys were here before us. Of course you're Americans. No, we have our distinct nationality or a cultural character that is separate from the United States. Even though there has been over 200 years of indoctrination, of forced assimilation, everything from residential schools to declaring us citizens 100 years ago, that doesn't necessarily make it true. Because your government can claim what they want to claim, but it doesn't necessarily make it true. They can declare what is good and what is evil. Doesn't necessarily make it true. We see it all over the world. We see the United States defending Israel in the face of no matter how many atrocities they commit against Palestinians. So this idea that America makes these claims, the United States. I hate to sometimes, you know, make that mistake of referring to the United States as America, because that word is essentially North and South America. It's the whole Western Hemisphere. It includes, even Greenland and Iceland. So it includes a lot of places that are not the United States. The United States is a really small space compared to what is considered, quote unquote, America. And of course, I don't know how Mexico or Canada or any South American countries feel about the United States claiming to be America almost exclusively, but that's another subject. But when we have these conversations, it sometimes is very, very difficult for people to wrap their heads around it. I've recounted a story here on this show before about meeting with congressmen and explaining, no, I'm not in your district. Yeah, but where do you live? I live on the Cattaraugus territory of the Seneca Nation. Oh, well, that's part of our district. Well, no, it's really not. Well, which side of the river do you live on? We have the Cattaraugus Creek that goes through. And I said, well, I live on the south side of the creek, or the, and they say, oh, well, that, well, there you go. Then you're in our district, or you're not in our district. And I said, look, I'm not talking to you as one of your constituents. I'm talking to you as a Native person who's affected by the legislation that you are a part of. And sometimes that conversation's a half an hour long before I can finally get through, because I'm only talking to aides, right? I'm not talking to the actual congressman or the senator or whatever else. So sometimes it's very, very difficult. We get into this conversation when we talk about land claims, when we talk about deeds. My friend, again, same friend, he lives here in Seneca Territory, and he has a deed for his property issued to him by the Seneca Nation. And when it was first given to him, it said, you know, all that property, and gives all the coordinates of the land, and, you know, where it sits, you know, on a map. And it says on the Cattaraugus Territory of the Seneca Nation. But then it also said in the town of Brant or Collins or whatever it was, the county of Erie and the state of New York. And he said, no, I don't want this deed. He goes, I don't need that other stuff on it. My land is on the Seneca Nation. I don't need town, county, and state. This isn't part of the town, county, and state. And so he sent his deed back, and he had them reissue it without all that other stuff on it. And this is part of the confusion, because there is a real inability for some of our own people to understand the distinction that we, not only that we have, but that we are oftentimes struggling to maintain. And of course, having the U.S. Congress in House and Senate assembled declare that we're citizens of the United States, when they have no right to do that. As I've said before on this program, there's a war crime that was established in like 1913 called denationalization. This is long before the word genocide was even developed or invented or you know, crafted, I guess. But denationalization was the idea of stripping away somebody's national character and imposing another nation's character upon them. Well, that's exactly what declaring us U.S. citizens was all about. And that came 10 years after this was already being established as a war crime. Now, look, when I talk about things like war crimes, or I talk about the concept of genocide, I always have to remind people, regardless of how much those words apply to what our life experiences have been, those concepts, denationalization, genocide, they weren't developed for us. I mean, in fact, it's somewhat problematic, because the language of these war crimes came out of atrocities that were mostly being committed in Europe. But when you read the language of it, I mean, when you read the language of what qualifies as genocide, like I've said it many times on the program, it reads like the playbook for residential schools: taking children, sterilization, killing our children, us as children, harming us physically, sexually, psychologically, creating the conditions by which our identity, our nations would cease to exist. That was the goal of residential schools. It was the goal of residential schools was to commit genocide in the most broad and stipulated definitions of the word. That's what the goals were. I mean, it's nice to flower it up a little bit and say, yeah, but it was education. Was it really? Because define education. It's not like this was a pathway to a college degree. Most kids spent very little time in learning the, you know, STEM subjects or even reading, writing, arithmetic. It was mostly working, and it was mostly punishment, and it was mostly indoctrination. Lots of prayer, all run by churches. So it was lots of prayer, lots of punishment, and lots of seeing to it that no Native identity would persist. Because that's what the goal was. It was literally to end our existence as a distinct people. And when it became less fashionable to kill us, this was the plan. And this plan was for 150 years. So when they decide that they're going to make us U.S. citizens, that's a declaration on the side of the United States. And, you know, as we go into what essentially will be June, which will mark the 100th anniversary, there ain't a whole lot of people talking about this, which kind of gets me back to doing this show. I know that if you listen to the show, you're going to hear something you haven't heard anybody else. I don't know anybody else talking about the 100th anniversary of the Indian Citizenship Act, especially if you do see it or hear it someplace. They aren't saying what I'm saying. I mean, I saw the U.S. Mint. They issued a commemoration, one of those Sacagawea coin, dollar coins, with the Indian Citizenship Act emblazoned on the back. Like, and literally what they said was, this historic landmark piece of legislation granted dual citizenship to Native people. And it did not. I mean, that's just wrong. It's a lie. I mean, it's a lie. Because you can't say that you've granted us dual citizenship if you want to refuse through 100 years of policy of trying to make us wards of the state. If you're going to refuse to acknowledge that we have our own identities, our own national identities, our own citizenship, if you will. I mean, that's not a word I'm really comfortable with, but that's part of the problem. You know, and it manifests itself in so many different ways. Let me shift gears a little bit here, because there's another anniversary that's coming up, and it starts this month. And it's the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the great Jim Thorpe longest run. And this was a run that went from New York City to Los Angeles 40 years ago. And there were runners that ran in stages of this thing, literally. And I, for some of those guys are friends of mine. And in fact, I did a show just the other day on my podcast, my Let's Talk Native podcast. And there's an irony to the whole Jim Thorpe story. I mean, Jim Thorpe was the product, as far as the athletics and, you know, and his act, you know, what he's recognized for was the fact that he was a superior athlete whose athletic skills was utilized, if not exploited, by the Carlisle Indian School. And he went on to win gold medals in two, again, to win a gold medal in the decathlon just means that you're just this phenomenal all-around athlete. But when he was in the Olympics in 1912, I think it was, and when he medaled, there was the pentathlon, which is 5 events, and the decathlon, which is 10 events. He won gold medals in both of those events, which even one of them would say, well, you're the greatest athlete in the world. But to win both of them, there's little question that you were the greatest athlete in the world at the time. And he couldn't represent his nation. He couldn't represent the Sac and Fox. He had to represent the United States. And ironically, the Indian Citizenship Act wouldn't be passed for another 12 years. So he may or may not, he probably wasn't a U.S. citizen, unless there was some other special thing that they did to crown him a U.S. citizen so he could run in the Olympics. I mean, and then he had his medal stripped away because he played a few games of baseball, and they call it professional sports. It wasn't enough to earn a living because he was a baseball player and a football player as well. It would take, I think, another 100 years before he would get those medals reinstated, and frankly, to his family. So in 1984, kind of reacting to the stripping of those medals and some of the other social activism that was happening on the Native front, and that was everything from the foster care, the abuse of foster care, and taking our children. Residential schools were essentially still operational to some extent. There was the, you know, the sovereignty movement. There was the American Indian movement. The push to reassert warrior societies in our territories. So there was a lot going on. Of course, there was the civil rights movement that was, you know, so prominent in the previous decade, but was still certainly running into the 80s. And of course, the other thing about 1984, boy, it's got a familiar ring to it, doesn't it? Was we were still premier lacrosse players in the 80s. Yet our teams could not compete in international play. We had a team called themselves the Iroquois Nationals at the time. And the Iroquois Nationals could not compete in any of the world games, not just the Olympics, but World Cup, any of the international events, Pan Am games. There's all kinds of different athletic events. So part of the run was to push to get the Iroquois Nationals to play in the World Cup, which was going to be at the in Los Angeles. And they indeed did play. I'm not saying it happened because of the run, but this was all part of what the motivation was. And so even as we're commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Jim Thorpe longest run, and we're doing some events here. We're actually encouraging people to register with the Cattaraugus Community Center. And by the way, you can look on my Facebook pages and see how to do that. Anybody can do this. You can register. You pay like $40, and you'll get a shirt sent to you and a pin. And then what we want to do is we want you to, if you're a runner, to log your how many miles you run from May 24th to July 19th. And if you're not a runner, then perhaps this is motivation to get you out there, run and walk and get some exercise. But if you log in your miles and send it to us, we're trying to accumulate enough miles to essentially represent the miles that was run in that original run, which is, it's between 3,000 and 4,000 miles. Because if you look on MapQuest, you can get it down to like 2,600 miles. But the guys who ran, because they went through some native territories, they ran closer to 4,000. It was like 3,900 miles they ran. So we're hoping to get people to sign up this year, this May through July, register with the Cattaraugus Community Center, and then log your miles. It's an honor system, so it's not like some real stringent process to go through. You just log in your miles, and you notify us, and they'll add to the tally. But part of what we're doing this, raising awareness to this right now, is in 2028, the Olympics are going to be hosted in Los Angeles. And once again, there's a fight. And news just kind of broke, but the fight has been whether the Haudenosaunee lacrosse team, men and women, I assume the women as well, will be allowed to compete in fact, I don't even know if women's lacrosse is in the Olympics. So you'll have to check me on that. But certainly men's lacrosse is. So the question is, will they be allowed to play? Now, I just heard just today that Joe Biden had stepped up and had put pressure on the Olympic Committee to allow the Iroquois National, Team Haudenosaunee, they don't call themselves the Iroquois National anymore, Team Haudenosaunee to compete in the Olympics. Now, by many accounts, we can field a team that is probably, certainly in the top three. I mean, We'll fight like hell to get a bronze medal. It's possible we could take out Canada or the United States, but those are the two dominant teams in international play. But we still rank very high. Top three is pretty damn high. But other teams are getting better and better, and of course we have a very small population to pull from. But the question that I have for Joe Biden is, all right, you can intervene and you can put pressure on the Olympic Committee to allow the Haudenosaunee lacrosse team to play. Well, what about your own State Department and putting pressure on your own State Department to recognize our passports? I mean, we've had trouble trying to compete internationally because when our boys have tried to travel on Haudenosaunee passports, or our women as well, I'm sorry, the men and women, they have been rejected by the United States. And if they're rejected by the United States, they're usually rejected by the host country as well. So I asked Joe Biden, when are you going to do something about recognizing our right to produce our own travel documents? And I'm not just talking about Haudenosaunee passports. I'm talking about any of our nations issuing our own travel documents, passports, if you will, or some means to satisfy the passport requirement. I mean, I literally can't leave the United States. I'm a hostage in the United States. I can't travel to another country because I reject the notion of U.S. citizenship. I can't even go into Canada at this point. I mean, even that's difficult. So, I mean, it's absurd that for all of the conversation about immigration and migration and movement. In fact, I spoke at an event at the UN several years ago where that was a topic: migration and movement, you know, refugee status, all that stuff. I said, well, it's ironic you're talking about this kind of stuff, and yet there are countries that are full-fledged member of the United Nations who won't accept the bare minimum that's laid out in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And our right to create our own travel documents is documented in there. Not specifically, but it's covered in that. And the United States nor Canada, and frankly, the host countries of these tournaments. I mean, there's been waivers given, but there is not recognition of our right to produce our own travel documents. So part of what we're hoping to do with this Jim Thorpe run is to launch another official coast-to-coast run for 2028. So, regardless of what gets worked out between now and then, and it may have been worked out about the Haudenosaunee team playing in the Olympics in Los Angeles, but it's not enough just to get waved in. There has to be a standard. And frankly, the international community has an obligation to recognize that we have existed longer than the United States, longer than probably the vast majority of countries that are a part of the United Nations or the Olympic Committee. And yet, because we don't fit their requirements or they've created these boxes that you have to fit into, well, maybe you need to redefine what a nation is, because that's what we go through. I mean, even using words like nation and citizenship as a native person, that's sometimes an awkward conversation because you have defined those words in a way that have political connections to it. I mean, just because I'm Mohawk doesn't mean, or Gunyagahaga doesn't mean that I endorse a specific native government. I live on the U.S. side of that imaginary line. The only Mohawk nation that the United States recognizes is the St. Regis Mohawk tribe. Well, I don't. You might, but I don't. So we get into a debate, well, then who is the Mohawk nation? What is the Mohawk nation? Well, part of the problem is what you're defining as a nation. See, we say we're a people. When I say Gunyagahaga, that means the people of the land where there's Flint, the land of Flint. That's what it means. It doesn't mean the nation. It doesn't mean, some definitive border. I mean, the way most countries try to define nationhood, although we can see time and time again how much border issues there are with countries and everything from immigration to, frankly, waging war and annexing and all kinds of other stuff. Like, the United States, it's interesting to watch them struggle with what's happening between Israel and Palestine and the role in the Ukraine-Russia war. And the United States is essentially talking out of two sides of its face because they illegally occupied and took over the Hawaiian kingdom. And they did it. They didn't even use any kind of legal process. They used a joint resolution of Congress to literally swallow up a nation, which is not their legal process. Their legal process is supposed to be involved a treaty. They get concurrence from the Senate, signed by the president. No, they did a joint resolution of Congress. That's not even, it's supposed to be 2/3 of the Senate that have to approve an international treaty for annexation. That's not what they did there. So, again, I hope when you listen to the show, you walk away with some piece of knowledge. Look, even if when you hear me say something and you don't believe it, then I hope you walk away with a question in your head that makes you want to find the answer. Because if I say something that doesn't seem quite right, by all means, check it out. Don't take my word for it. All I'm saying is hear me so you may know, so you will know a question to ask of yourself. I mean, look, we've got cell phones, we've got Google and all these search engines. We've got the internet in general. We have all kinds of means to resource information and to learn truths and, some not so true things. But certainly if you want to find out what the United States did to Hawaii, if you want to find out where the word genocide comes from or what denationalization meant coming out of, 1913, then do so. And you'll be forced to almost ask other questions. The more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know oftentimes. You'll learn something, but then in learning that, you will hopefully ask yourself more and more questions the more you learn. That's what I'm trying to do here with this program. That's why I try to come onto the air in New York City and Washington, D.C. every week, stream it live on Facebook, because I'm hoping that people will hear something that will first challenge them, First of all, I want to say something that challenges what you think you know, and then point you in a direction to either refute what I've said or, you know, or investigate what I've said to find out if it's true. So what you hear from me isn't necessarily knowledge, it's questions. The knowledge is what you seek out yourself. So that's what we do here. And that's why it's so important to have your support, to have you support WPFW and WBAI. I realize I'm not on air in New York this week, but again, even if you're listening on Facebook or if you're listening to the show as a podcast, I ask that you support those stations that carry this program. And this week we're airing in Washington, D.C. on WPFW, as we do every week. And I think it's really important that if you listen, that you, again, if you believe we are entitled to land back, then you should believe we're entitled to some airtime. But that airtime may be free to me, but it still costs the station. So I ask you to support WPFW by going to their pledge line, 202-588-9739, or go online to WPFWFM.org. And like I said, there's no amount that's too small except for no contribution whatsoever. And look, this is Washington, D.C. I know there are people who have earned lucrative careers in understanding the conflicts that Native people have endured. There's lawyers and there's lobbyists. I think there's more lobbyists than there are nations First Nations in the United States, probably Canada as well. There are more lobbyists in Washington than there are, Native peoples. I mean, you're all earning a living, and some of you are earning a living off of Native people. So I know you have the resources, because I know what the line item budget looks like for legal and for lobbying and that kind of stuff in a lot of these places, and it's pretty handsome. So if you're a lawyer that's either represented Native territories, or perhaps you're a lawyer that has, you know, tried to create legislation that we find somewhat problematic. Either way, you're making a buck. And if you're listening to this station, I hope that you will consider making a contribution. And if you're a lawyer, I hope it's a sizable contribution. I'm not looking for the $5 a week out of you guys. I'm hoping that some of you guys will step up and do $1,000. Do something meaningful to this station. And I know there are other great programs on the station. I know there are. But while I'm not suggesting that this program is the best show on radio or the most dangerous show on radio, what I am saying is you're going to hear something from me that you're not hearing anywhere else. And I hope what you hear makes you question what you think you know. That's what we're all about here. That's what we're trying to do. So as I said, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of the Jim Thorpe Longest Run. We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the Indian Citizenship Act. Also, May is it kicks off on May 5th. Missing and murdered Indigenous women, and now they're actually saying missing and murdered Indigenous people Awareness Day. And that's what we do for this month. For this month, we try to, you know, give a special effort to help people understand that this is a problem. This isn't just isolated incidents. There are Native people that, and women are the most vulnerable. Women and young women, girls, are the most vulnerable. If you are a Native woman, you are 5 times more likely to experience a sexual assault than a white woman, 5 times more likely. And 70% of the domestic violence or the sexual assaults or assaults period that occur against women are by non-Native. Now, it's still problematic that 30% are Native perpetrators, but the vast and overwhelming majority of the violence against our women comes from the outside. And we are essentially powerless, as far as the federal government is concerned, to prosecute take any legal action against a non-Native who commits a crime against our people, against our women, our children, our girls. And because the United States historically will always claim that they don't have the resources to investigate missing persons complaints. And of course, it's really easy for them to just write it off. Well, they probably just ran away. And you know what? Sometimes our people do run away. But you know what? You still have an obligation to investigate. But they'll say we don't have the resources. Of course, the states will say the same thing. County, state, any kind of municipal law enforcement. And here's the other problem. The other problem is that we don't exactly fare well when the law enforcement is involved. You know, the CDC just released a finding, essentially. So again, Center for Disease Control issued a finding that said Native men are 5 times more likely to die at the hands of law enforcement than white people. We're still even 3 times greater chance of dying at the hands of law enforcement than black people. And I guess I say that with some disbelief because we've seen so many instances between Sandra Bland and George Floyd and, you know, Freddie Gray and so many others. I mean, Timmer Rice, we see all these examples of men and women who have died at the hands of police officers, black men and women, boys, kids who have died at the hands of police officers. We can't imagine that there could be a group that has a death by cop rate higher than that, but we are. So three times greater chance, almost 3 times a greater chance of dying by cop if you're Native than if you're black. 5 times greater than if you're white. Now, granted, we're a small population, so the total numbers aren't very impressive, but the percentages are. And when you factor that in with the whole problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women or Indigenous peoples, you understand that we have an apprehension. Those numbers are probably even higher, but frankly, calling the cops isn't exactly something that's worked out well for us. So the problem is both on the law enforcement side because of resources and because of incompetence. And I got to tell you, I think that, frankly, as a Native person, I mean, I would take law into my own hands if something happened to a family member. And when you consider that it's somebody like George Zimmerman, who can play neighborhood watchman to the point where he kills an innocent young boy, kills an innocent young boy, and then doesn't get charged, I got to think maybe it's time for us to step up. You know, and I'm not saying throw complete caution to the wind. I'm not saying being vigilantes necessarily. But I got to tell you, something happens to one of the girls in my family, and there will be hell to pay. So we should organize, regardless of whether the federal government or the state government wants to authorize us to do it. I think we need to step up. I think we need better organization in our communities, with or without the federal government. And frankly, probably without is better, or the state government. We don't have great relationships with law enforcement. We just don't. And the resources are never put there. I mean, even Trump claimed to throw a couple of $1 million at increasing resources for missing and murdered Indigenous women. You know where a couple of $1 million goes? Nowhere. It gets swallowed up by white people through the bureaucracy. Anytime I hear people talk about the amount of money that goes into the Interior Department or the amount of money that Biden did this great infrastructure project and there were so many billions of dollars that was going to go into the Native territory. No, they weren't. You know what they're going to go for? The roads that you jammed through our territories. They're your roads that go through our territory, not ours. So don't make it sound like you handed over a bunch of money to us. Hell, we even have a debate. We had a major conflict with the New York State Thruway running through Seneca territory because the Seneca Nation insisted that there had to be Native crews that work on that road. And it created such an impasse between Andrew Cuomo and the Seneca Nation that Andrew Cuomo refused to fix the thruway. You had to slow down to like 45 miles an hour on the section of road that went through Seneca territory because it was so dilapidated. It was in such rough shape. Finally, I think the Obama administration forced Cuomo to fix the damn road. So this is the kind of relationships that we have. And it doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat. You know, again, getting out of get into the whole culture war thing. The culture war for us, it's us against them. It isn't right versus left. Because we frankly don't fare any better. Well, I guess the Haudenosaunee lacrosse team gets to play in the Olympics because of Joe Biden. But we don't solve the travel documents issue. So we don't fare any better with Democrats than we do with the Republicans. So, I mean, that's another reason for when somebody comes up to us and says, oh, would you like to register as a Democrat? No, I don't. I don't want to. Because, frankly, we've got a Democratic governor in the state of New York that is, frankly, squeezing every dime she can out of Native people to put her name up in lights. Oh, she's responsible for getting a new stadium built for the Buffalo Bills. Yeah, after she extorted $500 million out of the Senecas. So, yeah, we have problems with the political systems of the United States. We do. And they're serious problems. They aren't small issues. They are significant issues. And it's just as bad. Well, I guess we could try to measure, is it just as bad with Democrats as it is with Republicans, or is it so close to the same that it doesn't matter? And for us, we will not choose the lesser of two evils in a situation like this, because it's still evil one way or the other. And there's a, you know, I could do a whole nother show, and I've done shows in the past about why we won't vote in U.S. or state or national elections. And we've got very good reasons for it. I mean, frankly, we don't vote. I mean, from a traditional standpoint, voting isn't our way. So if you're Longhouse or if you're traditional, you are probably opposed to this idea of registering and casting a ballot, because this notion of one man, one vote, 50% plus one defeats 50% minus one is not something that makes sense to us. I mean, it makes sense to you. I get majority rule. I get the idea. I get the concept. The problem is the unhappy minority is sometimes so close to the majority that you end up with a lot of different disenfranchised people. Our systems are different. So there's a lot of reasons why we don't vote even in native elections, because a lot of the native governments have been altered through federal policies, including the Indian Reorganization Act, to model themselves after American democracy or U.S. democracy, if you want to use that word. And frankly, that's not our way. So voting isn't something that we are prone to do anyway, but voting in your elections, yeah, we're even less prone to do that. So having said that, I tell everybody, if all you do is vote, then you're not doing enough. And in fact, I don't care if U.S. citizens vote in their elections or not, because the people who get elected, regardless, are accountable to you. The problem is that if the only way anybody feels that they can hold a U.S. politician accountable is to vote every 2 years or 4 years for them, then you're not giving much, you're not holding them very accountable. Man, you need to be, yeah, sure, pitch your tents across campuses of the United States. Protest against the aggression that Israel is showing in Gaza. But you know what? There are a lot of other issues that you could be pitching that tent in front of your state capitals or in Washington. Because what the governments are doing in large part is just wrong. And we're so prone to jump into these culture wars, and we're going to grab one issue and hang on to it: abortion, immigration, Israel, Gaza. We'll make a lot of noise about that one issue, but we don't hold anybody accountable. And it's the same in Native territories. As you know, I've been involved in some of the land claim settlement discussions up in Mohawk territory, up in Akwesasne. That's at the top of the state. Actually, Akwesasne straddles the U.S.-Canadian border. Part of it is in what's considered Quebec. Part of it's in Ontario, and part of it's in New York. And it causes jurisdictional nightmares not from the outside, but for us, because Canada will endorse a band council on one side, the U.S. will endorse a tribal council on the other side. And in the meantime, the vast majority of Mohawk people, Gunyagahaga, are indifferent about these arms of the Canadian and U.S. government that pose as tribal governments. So this is the complication that exists. There's no easy, I mean, it's not even easy to explain, let alone easy to come up with an answer for some of these problems, like settling a, you know, a disputed land issue. Because the United States position is, well, let us just give you some money and we'll call it even. Or we'll give you some money and we'll let you have a few acres here, a few acres there, but we're going to enter this deal with the idea of extinguishing further claims. Well, that's a problem. That's a problem for us. And that's what we're experiencing with Akwesasne right now. You have illegitimate leadership claiming to have the support of the will of, and the will of the people behind them when they don't. And they're selling out the birthright of our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, future generations. So these are the complicated issues. And I know you may find another Native radio show. You may find many other Native podcasts. But I know when you listen to my show, you're going to hear something you haven't heard anywhere else. And you'll probably hear a perspective that is not widely held in the public. And I say that because I don't have a whole lot of Native people who will counter what I say. I'm not saying everybody agrees with me completely. But there's not a whole lot of people that will publicly debate me on these issues because they either know I'm right or their position is wrong enough that it's indefensible. And I went through this on the land claims issue up in Akwesasne. And people try to say, well, you're just misinformed. I said, well, show me where I'm misinformed. Show me where I've misrepresented something. And, you know, when you call people out on issues like that, you find that their argument goes away. It's the same thing. I mean, part of the thing that I worked a lot on as of late was the mascot issue. Now, when I go into a community, often that's because I've been invited into a community to talk about the mascot issue. I don't go in there trying to tear people up or you know, screaming, you know, at people or calling them blatant racists or white supremacists. The conversation gets there sometimes, but I don't come out of the gate that way. Oftentimes, I get met with the hostility. And if you continue to stand on principle, you realize that the arguments that are cast against you don't have much to stand on. And those folks who maintain that they want to be able to call themselves Indians, chiefs, raiders, savages, warriors, or whatever else, they find themselves on pretty shaky ground. And oftentimes they'll resort to just being insulting and, you know, getting ugly in the conversations. And that makes their argument even weaker because now, clearly, you've demonstrated your own racism in the conversation. I mean, I've been dealing with this thing in Minooka, Illinois. And there is a town that picked a name that may or may not really have been Native, or what it really means is even unclear to them. And they call themselves the Indians. And, you know, I even did a Zoom call with their Board of Education. I explained it all to them. I couldn't have made it more clear. And I wasn't hostile to them. But ironically, one of the more famous folks from Minooka is an actor and writer by the name of Nick Offerman. He was, if you know Nick Offerman as an actor, I think he was in Parks and Recreation and a few other series. I've seen him in a couple of movies. But he also has written some pretty neat books about traveling. One book that he wrote was about called Where the Deer and the Antelope Play. And it's about he and his buddy going to all these national parks. But at some point he goes home and he gets dragged in. And this is in the book. He gets dragged into the conversation about mascots. And I think Nick Offerman's dad was even the mayor of Minooka. I don't know if at that time or previously. And at some point he enters into his book, again, Where the Deer and the Antelope Play, a passage in there about how in the midst of all this hate and all this hateful talk, because he sided with changing the mascot at his high school. And, of course, people got angry as hell and were hurling all kinds of expletives at him, that kind of stuff. And he said, but every once in a while, you get a voice of reason. Because there's one guy who was insisting that you just need to watch this video by a guy named John Kane called We're Not Your Mascot. And he says, and I watched it. This is Nick Offerman saying this. And I watched it. And what he said was reasonable. And he came to the conclusion that the decision whether to use a native mascot or not should be left to the people who are affected by it, the native people that whose images are being appropriated. So that's one of Minooka, Illinois' favorite sons. And he didn't have to put this passage in a book. I mean, his book was basically about going to national parks, you know, not to deal with the mascot issue, but somehow as he happened to go through his hometown on one of his trips, he got sucked into the controversy. And yeah, so anyway, I recommend that you check out his book and you see the passage that he wrote, because it's more than that, but he spends a little bit of time with it. And he got pulled into it by his nieces, by the way, which was kind of neat as well, because it kind of shows you what happens in a non-native community when there's a debate over something like this. And that's part of the reason I do what I do. Look, I oftentimes bring this up when we talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women, because part of the problem has been the objectification of women in general, but Native women in particular. And we see it. Look at Disney's Pocahontas. I mean, lots of legs showing, lots of skin showing for a 12-year-old girl. And, of course, this massive white man who, they suggest that there was some romantic relationship between Pocahontas and John Smith, which isn't even true. But this is, of course, this gets captured in romance novels, especially the ones that are Western-based. You always have some voluptuous Native woman who you see in Hollywood, you see it on television. This is the image that was created. And, of course, the rape culture that came from Europe in the first place can't be ignored. I mean, every time somebody talks about Native people just not having the resistance for the diseases that Europeans brought them, they always skip right ahead to, like, influenza and smallpox. But we miss the first wave of disease that came off of those people getting off a boat, which was venereal disease. Captain Cook, famous cartographer from the UK who traveled the South Pacific, he wrote in his journal when he had discovered Hawaii that he had concerns about his men going ashore because of how many deaths would be caused because of the disease that they carried with them, the venereal disease. So he wasn't just speculating out of thin air. He knew that this had happened already. So the wave of deaths that came from Europe weren't just at the end of a sword or a musket, a saber. No, it was at the end of from a rape culture, and the diseases that were when we talk about diseases that were spread by accident. Well, I don't know if you rape somebody, if that's considered an accident. Look, airborne disease is one thing, but venereal disease, it, and don't tell me it takes two to tango, because if you're enslaving somebody, or if you're forcing yourself on somebody, that's not tango, that's rape. So, again, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Awareness Month, anniversary of the Jim Thorpe Longest Run, begins this month. And we're coming up on June, which is the 100th anniversary of the Indian Citizenship Act. So there's always plenty to talk about. I hope that as you listen to this program, you feel like you walk away with something. Look, and I realize that I sometimes have to repeat subjects. I know it's not the same people listening every week. So I don't apologize for that. It's a necessity. But if you listen to the show on the radio, if you're listening on WPFW, I hope that you'll support the station. If you're listening online, if you're listening as a podcast or a Facebook live stream, I still hope you support the radio station. In this case, we're only airing in Washington this week, so I ask that you support WPFW, and their pledge line, once again, as I finish the program, is 202-588-9739, or go online to WPFWFM.org. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for joining me. I want to thank you, those of you who come back each week, and I look forward to your comments on Facebook and on whatever platforms you guys reach out to me on. I greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening. I'm John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio.